Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 158 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This week, we will be discussing chapter 3 of my favorite book, Voyager, by Diana Gabaldon. Chapter 3 is entitled Frank and the Full Disclosure.
There's a bit to read into for this title. Frank disclosure, that is disclosure that is direct and honest. But also, we have lots of Frank in this chapter, the character. Well, compared with most of DIA and Voyager, at least thus far. And full disclosure, well, that's kind of self-explanatory.
Did I say Frank and the full disclosure? I hope I said Frank and full disclosure, because that's what I intended to say.
Lisa T. writes, wondering if this should be Frank, comma, and full disclosure. Perhaps a bit of both? Donna Kay also points out the dual meaning of Frank of the title and goes further. Full disclosure is, of course, only on Claire's part because she tells Frank the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about where she's been, how she got there, Jamie, and the pregnancy. On the other hand, we learn nothing in this chapter about Frank's life for the 3 years Claire was gone.
We don't learn anything about the time that he's gone. I think that we learn what they're willing to show us and what Claire has observed, but we don't really learn the truth. We don't know what Frank knows.
Claire's opinion of what she's observed. Or I should say, we learn what she's observed, that's correct, and the conclusions she's drawn from that. Connie S. writes, did she also tell Roger all these details, or are we supposed to view this only in Claire's memory? I think it's the latter.
I think this is Claire's memory. I don't think she's telling this to... I'm fairly positive she is not telling Bree about the time her dad relieved her milk.
Yes,
ducts.
I agree.
So that being said, I'm fairly sure this is just a memory. And the fact that it's italicized, yeah, to me makes it more of a memory as opposed to something she's telling someone.
Connie continues, this chapter alone, with Claire's comments about Frank's supposed philandering, is used frequently to provide ammunition that Frank cheated, but we also learn from Frank that, quote, Frank was not a cad, unquote, and that he was a, quote, very decent man. Thus, two ideas of Frank are held in tension in the very same chapter. And there's a lot more to say later on in the chapter about that. We are in Inverness, May 9th, 1968. Diana doesn't always give us dates, sometimes months with the year, but the fact that she's done so each chapter in Voyager shows that the date is important and perhaps we are counting down to something.
To me, it feels like because we're doing the jumping, because we started back in the 1740s right after Culloden, I think it's important that we have that, not a standard, but like, It's setting a standard for what we're expecting for this book, because important things are happening and it's important that we know when we are and not just where we are. So knowing that we're in Inverness, especially in a story like this where it's, you know, multi-tiered and there's different time periods, I think we have to know, especially when we're going to be running both time periods simultaneously like this, we have to know where we are.
Claire and Roger are walking over the River Ness. Like, I remember this. I did this a few times this past April. Did you ever go to over one of the bridges when we were in Inverness last year?
No, we were just on the one side of the river.
Okay.
I looked at the River Ness. Not while I was there, but there was a gigantic rainbow when we were in Inverness.
I remember that.
That like was all the way across the sky.
Claire is internally freaking out. Whether Jamie did die at Culloden or survived, one would be confirmatory but still heartbreaking. The other would be earth-shattering, but open up her future and change her life once again in a way she had never foreseen. Donna Kay echoes this. Fearful Claire. Claire's heart is beating heavily, fearful of potential outcomes of their search through records for what happened to Jamie. She describes their walk as trudging back to the manse, her arms aching from the weight of the books she is carrying, and perhaps from the weight of the decision she is contemplating. Lisa T. writes, again, Diana reminds us of the sense of purgatory and limbo, of Claire's grief for Jamie after thinking him dead, and the sense of grief and sheer frustration to find him alive only to be separated from him by time.
Well, that, and think about it. She feels like not only is she separated by time, but now she's lost 20 years or however old Brianna is at this point, 19, 20. She's lost all of these years that she could have been back with him because of the assumption that he did what he intended, which was to die at Culloden. So I think it's a combination of all those things.
Eileen P. writes, the search for answers is extremely stressful for Claire. If Jamie had died, Claire will once again grieve his loss as she had 20 years earlier, except this time there will be a heart-wrenching finality. However, if he hadn't died at Culloden, there will be the grief of having been separated from her soulmate for 20 years, as Summer just said. I have to say that I feel a personal connection to this situation, having been separated for the love of my life for 20 years. There was a point where I thought he had died, and I mourned his loss. Okay, hold on a second. Record scratch. What, Eileen P? You can't say that and then not tell us.
We need a little bit more backstory on that. Did you go through the stones? I mean, what? How?
Don't
what
say that
kind of
because
separation?
We don't know what happened. It could have been. It was sad, but it could. Wow. So basically, Eileen, and if you want to keep it private, that's fine. Number one, you don't owe us anything, but you like really did like tickle us there and then not complete the. The thing.
I mean, I don't like being tickled, but I would like to know the rest of the story.
If you want to email us, that's fine. We're happy not to share it, but that you just like gave us this most fascinating entree to what you have.
We're hella nosy, Eileen. Bring it back.
No, Summer's
come on,
nosy.
Eileen.
I'm curious. The two had spent time at the Society for the Preservation of Antiquities while Brianna was at the Highland Clan's office to get other papers. She thanks Roger for getting involved, for doing all this work. His reply? It's all right. I'm curious. You know historians that can't live a puzzle alone. And yes, she did know historians. Eileen P. writes, regarding the puzzle of whether Jamie died at Culloden, Claire notes, quote, Frank hadn't wanted to leave this particular puzzle alone either, but neither had he been willing to solve it, unquote. Maybe Frank was curious but afraid to find out that Jamie hadn't died. He was probably afraid that Claire would leave him and take Brianna with her. He also might not have wanted to solve it because he didn't want to believe Claire's story about time traveling. Another possibility was that Frank could have solved the puzzle, but chose not to as a way of punishing Claire for loving Jamie.
Another solution is he did solve it and was just enough of a dick to not tell her.
And we can't say anything more.
No,
Summer.
I'm just saying that's another possibility.
If you're listing possibilities. Lisa T. writes, so a moment for Frank and full disclosure. We wonder, since Frank was an historian, what did he actually know? How much research did he do into the past? Did he find Jamie and even Claire? So basically, Frank, comma, but not full, comma, disclosure. So as they are talking, Diana describes the sun being high in the sky so far north, and it shone on the lime trees on the riverbank and on the granite cenotaph that stood below the bridge. According to Merriam-Webster, a cenotaph is, quote, a special structure or statue that is built to remind people of a dead person who was buried somewhere else, especially a structure built to honor the people who were killed in a war. Huh, interesting. So they're looking for someone, Jamie, who may have died in a war. Well, obviously he didn't die at Culloden, but they're trying to figure out, did he die, right? Trying to confirm it. So looking for someone who may have died in a war, but definitely dead in 1968. And the sun is shining all over the place. Jamie was the sun. And the starlight called through the puddles in the prologue. And a star was safety if one fell through a puddle and could all hold on to it, according to Claire's child mind. As far as the symbolism of lime trees, I found, quote, healing, love, and protection. As well as, quote, lime trees convey the meaning of the eternal mysteries of intimacy, attraction, and lovers, unquote. And I'll give both of those citations, those references, those sources in the show notes.
Was this you? Were you the tree lady? Okay.
That was all me.
I'm just wondering if somebody else has picked up the mantle or if it's you.
No, girl. I started the trees on our show and I will continue the trees on our show.
So you're saying if somebody sent you an email with tree stuff in it, you would do your own research first and then maybe quote them?
Never. I always do my own first. Even if we get 20, you know, people giving us all the... We actually got almost all of the feedback or the comments before I did my notes. I never look at anything. I reply, I save it, and I thank them. But I never read it before I do mine. But, so I did the tree stuff first. But we got this from Lisa. Lisa T. writes, there are also lime trees present. Lime trees are also symbolic of fertility. But even more significant is the story of the lovers. Oh, Lord, I'm going to butcher this. Bauchis, and Philemon? It's not Bacchus. By Ovid, a near contemporary of Catullus of Dalmibasia. Mile fame, who were turned into a lime tree and an oak after they died. She being the lime, Jamie is also referred to as an oak. Hold that thought for a second and follow me on this one. Finally, we have a glowing granite cenotaph below the bridge, and Claire often refers to Jamie as feeling solid granite. Okay, so we have a bridge to represent time travel, living lime trees representing Claire and fertility, and a glowing granite cenotaph which commemorates but does not hold earthly remains. So we have a metaphor for Claire crossing to Jamie, who is indeed alive in his time, his remains unknown in hers. So she did the trees as well because she was, well, first of all, she just did it, but she was connecting, using the bridge to connect the two and the time and all that.
So she did more than you. She gave you more.
She found something I didn't find on the lime trees, but she connected them in a different way. I connected them of Jamie being the sun. She didn't mention that, but Jamie being the sun, and just like someone else pointed out that the starlight or whatever was calling or could be calling there or be safe if she traveled through that puddle and had to grab onto a star. I was hearkening back to the prologue or what we said in the last episode.
I was mostly teasing you, but you kind of went with it, so that's okay.
They chat about how Roger had asked Dr. Linkletter for a list of the Jacobite officers who were in Leonach farmhouse after Culloden, if it existed, regarding the survivor and what were the original sources. Diana gives us another description of Roger's eyes, a brilliant, lucent green, and he had olive skin.
Sorry, Richard Rankin. You failed.
On all accounts.
You have no olive skin.
He is Scottish, though.
You have no green eyes. But you're darling. We'll accept you.
Claire knows that though he might be curious, Roger's interest was in Brianna, and that she was also interested in him. But did Roger know this? Now, this is Ginger, not another contributor. I offer something to consider. While nothing to the effect has been hinted at yet in Voyager, in DIA there is quite a bit of description, comparatively, of Claire's effect on Roger. While he, of course, wouldn't thinking of going for her, and he is definitely interested in Brianna, there's also Claire to think of. Helping her, or them, out would not only use his historian skill, but allow him to grow closer to Brianna, and enable him to remain close contact with Claire.
Well, I think it's one of those things where you're like, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. This is maybe the way to Brianna's heart is through her mother. I don't know. It definitely can't hurt to be on mom's good side, for sure.
I don't think it has anything to do with going through Claire to get Brianna. He's doing enough with Brianna on his own.
It couldn't hurt,
maybe, with a mom. I'm talking about Claire for Claire's sake. He is attracted to Claire.
Not like that, though.
Oh, not like he wants to marry her and jump her... Well, maybe jump her bones.
I mean, he's made it clear that she's a well-put-together woman of her age.
That's what I'm saying.
But that's not the same thing as being like, hey, how you doing?
I didn't say that.
Well, yeah,
I'm saying
but
he
you
found
like...
her attractive. No Roger bathtub.
No, he's not scrying on her or nothing.
Exactly. Back at the manse, Claire sits while Roger goes to get some lemonade. Now, this may be overkill, but I also had to look up lemons. Heck, we just had lime trees, so there's a lot of citrus. This chapter is heavy on the citrus. According to CatholicTradition.org, the lemon is a symbol of fidelity and love, and as such, is associated with the Virgin Mary.
How do you find these websites?
I just use
Google.
According
to CatholicBlahBlah.com, I'm like, how is that your go-to?
It's not. I Googled it, and then it came up.
You're like, according to ILikeLemonTrees.com.
No, you type in lemon symbolism.
According to CitrusIsMyBitch.com. Like, seriously.
According to CatholicTradition.org, the lemon is a symbol of fidelity and love, and as is associated with the Virgin Mary. In art, citrus has been associated with weddings, marriage, and love.
And lemonade.
In German-speaking Europe, lemons symbolize the hope of resurrection and eternal life. It was mostly the lemon from the Baroque age to the mid-20th century that was put into the hand of the laid-out body and cast into the open grave. Lemons were also given as get-well gifts for the sick.
Well, vitamin C is helpful.
It's get-well.
It's like, it's anti-scurvy. Get it done.
Donna Kay writes, Roger as protector, helper, and confidant for women in his life. Roger caring for Claire and Brianna, caring for women without male protectors, being key to his personality that we will discover in future books. Roger protects Claire on their walk across the bridge over the River Ness. Protection from the pedestrians, quote, with his wide shoulders, creating a path ahead of her through the crowd. Protection from the bicycles by nudging her out of the way of an oncoming cyclist who would have hit her. Back at the manse, Roger makes Claire comfortable serving her lemonade and then whiskey. Roger explains why he cares enough to help Claire and Brianna, calling it professional curiosity, typical of all historians. Claire thinks it is because Roger also cares for Brianna, but not in a platonic way. Lisa T. writes, this passage is particularly interesting as first the hour is growing late, the day or window of time to find Jamie is drawing near, and Roger and Claire are crossing a bridge, this reminiscent of traveling through time. We see that Roger had a number of Frank's books, one of them called The Jacobites. She said no, she couldn't read them, and she refused to look at anything dealing with Scotland's past. Funny, this is perhaps my, Ginger's, greatest complaint over how they handled season two, the reason for why she doesn't go looking for Jamie. Not because she couldn't bring herself to, though certainly that could have been part of it, but because she promised Frank she wouldn't, right? In the series, TV series, she promises him she won't.
It's true. Now, in the books, she does make a promise to Frank, but it's not that she won't look back. It's that she won't
mention him.
She won't tell Brianna anything while he's still alive.
Exactly.
So there is still a promise exacted from her, but it is not the same one.
To me, this shows Claire as less strong. In the books, it's her decision, perhaps out of fear, but it's her decision. There can also be said to be strength, however, in keeping a promise. So that also takes commitment. But while she decided to agree to Frank in the TV series, it wasn't her idea. Whereas in the books, it was completely her idea to not go looking for Jamie. Not about not telling Bree. I'm not talking about the Bree bit. Claire tells Roger that, yes, she did tell Frank everything about the stones and Jamie. An important piece of information. Roger asks if he believed her. She says not at first. In truth, she doesn't know the answer. So even at this point in time, she doesn't know for certain if Frank believed her.
No. No, that's true. And we may have differing opinions
Stop
about that
right
later.
There. Okay. Absolutely. Ellen G. writes, it is interesting that Claire feels comfortable speaking to Roger. Maybe it's the taste of Scotch whiskey they both imbibe. I think it helps her to speak of Frank to someone. And when she told him about Frank's inability to have any children of his own, his being a historian and all, how awful that would make him feel. And then we go into italics, which means it's reverie from the past. First, Claire tells us that her return was much worse than a trip to the past. First time, it was unexpected, and she had, quote, a protective layer of doubt and disbelief where I was and what was happening, and had lived in constant hope of escape, unquote. The second trip, she was completely aware of what she was doing, where she was going, and what she was leaving behind, and that there would be no escape. At first, Claire says there was no room in her for anything but grief and terror. Her mind's eye is seeing the Rainy Moor and Jamie's face, the last thing before she went through the stones. She didn't look around much because she wanted to hold on to the sights she'd seen and didn't want to lose them. We are reminded of the J Jamie cut into the base of her thumb. She dreams of the last few days before Culloden and of the dead man with the blue corpse fungus.
I dream about that too. It's something you can't really get out of your head when you think about it. And again, please don't Google.
Hannibal.
Please don't Google.
Oh gosh. I just think of Hannibal when I think of that now. And of course, Dougal's also dead and she thinks about him. She would be in and out of dreams, the world of the hospital incongruous with that of her Gaelic-filled dreams of men preparing for their final battle. Diana writes, quote, "And fall asleep again, my hurt clutched tight in the palm of my hand," unquote. Now, is this symbolic that she concentrates her pain into this one place where she is clutching her hands together? Or is it only the hurt of her hand where Jamie cut her?
I think the hurt of her hand is the reminder she needs that it was real. So for her, that's the physical reminder.
So she's like trying to cause that.
Yeah.
Because it's like, oh, thank God, this is real.
Yeah,
like,
and she was saying that when she was in the hospital room waiting to see what would happen, she would kind of zone out. And if she stared at anything too closely, it would take her out of her reverie. So it was, she had to like focus on a far off spot. It's like those, for me, I think of those 3D eye puzzles where it looked like nothing. Oh. And then you'd stare through them and all of a sudden there would be dinosaurs and stuff, whatever those magic, whatever they were called. But for me, it's like that, where she's trying to remember and envision and get her brain in the mindset of where she wanted to be, which was not in the 1940s. And anytime she focused too closely on anything around her, she would lose her focus. So she, having the physical reminder of Jamie with her, was something that I'm sure helped her keep her sanity in a time when everyone was questioning it.
And then she woke and Frank was there. Neither of them spoke at first. She now differentiates him from BJR and Alex Randall. Quote, "He had neither the spirituality of Alex nor the icy arrogance of Jack. His lean face looked intelligent, kind, and slightly tired, unshaven, and with smudges beneath his eyes. I knew without being told that he had driven all night to get here," unquote.
I kind of miss the series adaptation of this scene where she goes, "Hello, Frank. I'm back." "Well, I'm back." It's kind of like that. I mean, and she does her own kind of version of it where she's like, "Hello, Frank. I'm pregnant," which is kind of like, that's her version, I guess, of breaking the ice. Well, and clearly in the book, she wanted him to leave. She wanted him to be so upset that he did not stay. And she was completely prepared to live her life solitary and alone with just her and whatever the baby ended up being. Once it was born, and she was trying to push him away. So
here we have our first glimpse of Frank since she left him in 1945. He's driven all night to be with her, his wife. He still cares, at least enough to come to her and see what this is all about. How has his wife returned after 3 years? He asks her if she's all right. She replies, "I'm pregnant." She planned to tell him, and then he would leave, and then she would be alone with her last sight of Jamie's face and his touch on her hand. He asks what happened, and she tells him. She still has a feeling of obligation to him. Not guilt, not yet, Diana writes. She had been married to him. Well, she actually was still married to him, but it's interesting that just returned Claire puts Frank fully in her past. Yes, he was there, but he is now also her future. She ends with, quote, "Well, I fell in love with someone and I married him. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it." She sounds a bit like a child here, doesn't she? Like he's asking her like where she was and what happened, but she's like going, not just saying what happened, even though it sounds crazy town. She's at least saying she feels bad. And I think we know she went through a huge struggle in Outlander, so she did feel bad, but she just sounds like she's almost over explaining now. Although how do you explain what happened? You really don't. You really can't, except by saying it and hoping that someone...
I don't think she's over-explaining. I think she's oversimplifying what happened. I met someone. I married him. I couldn't help it.
No, she said she couldn't help but falling in love.
Either way. The point is she's accepting the blame, but also deflecting the blame. She's like, "I met someone. I fell in love with him. I couldn't help it."
He thinks she's being facetious and won't have it. She understandably is pissy that he would think that. She tells him the truth, and here he goes dogging her for it.
But can you blame him?
Absolutely not.
Because this is fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if somebody disappeared for however long and then came back and their story was, "Oh, I went through these stones back 200 years and I got married. Oh, and by the way, I'm pregnant. Sorry, I tried. I did what I could."
I'm going to use a word that I learned actually from I mean, I don't think I'd heard it before. I started listening to some Sophie Kinsella, some audiobooks, but she uses the words in her Shopaholic series. She uses the word fantasist a lot. I'm like, I love that word, fantasist. So Claire, he's like, he's thinking she's a fantasist.
He's thinking she's batshit crazy. He's thinking that she's off her rocker.
That's true.
He calls in doctors to test her because he thinks she's effing crazy.
He grabs her and tells her she will tell him where she's been and what she's been doing. And then she tells him she met Jack Randall there. She shocks him with her mention and description of BJR.
It's a bloody pervert.
She describes her semi-forced marriage to Jamie and then how she fell in love with him. She apologizes, says she did try to come back, but couldn't. And then she starts to cry. She continues to believe he'll leave. Quote, look, I know you won't want to have anything more to do with me, and I don't blame you at all. Just go away, will you?
I feel bad for Frank here because, and this is probably the only time I ever feel bad for Frank because Frank is not my favorite. But I feel bad for him because he's kind of in a damned if he does, damned if he doesn't situation here because if he leaves her, he's the cad and the bad dude who ditched his wife, he's leaving this poor defenseless woman on her own, pregnant, unable to care for herself so far as society cares. And he's, you know, the worst sort of human being you can be, whereas he also in the process is now going to be raising a stranger's child. However, conversely, he's incapable of having kids. So this is like almost a kismet situation where he's like, yay, I get my wife back and I get a bonus kid that I wouldn't have been able to have on my own. So, I mean, there's a part of me that thinks that he is incredibly magnanimous in his accepting of Claire and her situation back into his life. And then at the same time, it feels really selfish because it's not necessarily what she wanted. And he kind of was like, well, I'm not leaving because everyone would look down on me and think poorly of me if I left. So, I mean,
so you're saying it's not just that it may not just be that he is actually a mensch. It could be also that he doesn't want anyone else thinking he's not a mensch.
Right. There's a lot, like there's so many layers to the perception of Frank and what other people might think of him if he left. I mean, of people thinking of him if he stays. I mean, he's kind of in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
That's why they went to Boston.
Boston.
Frank isn't the man she thought he would be. Diana writes, quote, his face changed. He didn't look angry anymore, but distressed and slightly puzzled. I'm not going anywhere, he said quite gently. He took my hand again, though I tried to pull away. This Jamie, who was he? Unquote. He accepts her when all she wants or expects him to do is leave. And he goes a step further. He asks about Jamie. She states his whole name. Remember, Frank is a historian. I wonder if this is the point at which it clicks for him that he might be able to check up on some of the details.
Now that was something she didn't do in the series that I really wanted. I think anytime anyone introduces him to somebody else, they should always have to say his full name.
Oh, Jamie?
Yeah. Like when you're like, oh, well, who was he? James Alexander Malcolm McKenzie Fraser. They should always have to do that.
It's like a superhero name and a serial killer name. You know, whenever they have like the serial killer and they show their mug photo? Oh my gosh.
Mugshot? Mug photo. When they show their mug photo,
the picture you're going to put up on my mug.
It says world's best serial killer.
When they have the mugshot.
His mug photo.
Whatever. Where did that come from?
Your brain.
I don't even know.
We're sleeping.
When they have the mugshot, it's like, or not even because of the shot, but with the shot. And whenever they mention, like, so-and-so is on trial for blah, 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 blah. They always use, like, John Wayne Gacy or something. Like, it's all
I mean, the best serial killers have more than one name. However, you know, like, Jeffrey Dahmer's just Jeffrey Dahmer.
That's true. Maybe he didn't have a middle name, though.
I mean, Charles Manson is just Charles Manson.
Maybe he didn't have a middle name.
They all have middle names. It's just not nearly as fun as John Wayne Gacy.
Anyway, there's more than just John Wayne Gacy. That was the first one that came to my brain.
It's a three.
Is he the clown guy?
Threefer.
That's freaky town.
Maybe.
I think so.
Ted Bundy was just Ted Bundy.
Okay, stop. My point is, there's legitimately just one.
No! You're trying to make a case for all serial killers based on one dude. But I need you to name one more, or this doesn't work. No Google.
I have to Google. No, this is a thing. I promise you it's a thing.
It's really not. I bet it's Charles Edward Manson. Sounds way too, like, proper.
Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay, not serial killers, but killers.
Okay. John Wilkes Booth.
Oh, actually, I was about to say, this is a list of noted political assassins. Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, John Wilkes Booth.
John
Wayne Serial
Gacy.
Killers. Gary Leon Ridgway. I don't know who he is.
No one knows that.
John Wayne Gacy and Paul John Knowles. I don't know the last one. But there's a lot of...
You should have stuck with assassinists, because that was...
Assassinists?
Was that a word?
No.
The assassinators?
Assassins.
Assassins. Thank you. Assassinators. Assassinators. I'm making up words right and left,
people.
No,
you said assassinists.
I know. I did. I made an ass out of me.
Lordy.
I think you should have stuck with assassins, because you had 3 for 3 right there. They were really good ones that everyone knows.
But I didn't come up with any of those.
I'm just saying, I read them. I said you should have gone with that instead of serial killers, because only one of the serial killers was somebody we've heard of.
So Claire tells him the facts. He was a Highlander. He was killed at Culloden. Frank sees her silver ring, Jamie's ring, and she freaks out, and rightly so, when Frank tries to pull it off. Then Frank was ushered away, and by some of the nurses, I believe, and she was given an injection of something to relax her.
And in the series, when she offered to take the ring off, there was an upheaval. Like, people were like, no, really upset when she almost took the ring off. And he was like, no, take your time. You don't have to do that right now. But that was almost
a bit far.
Yeah, that was, people were real upset about that.
I would have been upset she had taken it off. Dude, if he burned the clothes, what would have happened to the ring? Sent it off to somewhere to get whatever. Frank's parting words to her, quote, all right, but Claire, I will know, unquote. So we can see right there that he is on intent.
Intent.
We can see right there that he is intent on knowing.
But think of how frustrating that is for Claire, who is legitimately telling him the truth from the moment she shows back up. And he's like, I will have the truth. And she's like, I've given you the truth. I am continually giving you the truth. And you don't believe me. So I don't know what else I can do for you.
Joe B. writes, I love the way of bringing Claire back to herself after her journey back by relating it to Frank. Claire, who has always been practical and resourceful, can't rationalize or plan her way out of this grief. And with Frank's coming, she is now literally faced with her two pasts, before she traveled and then when she was with Jamie, and potentially her future. And her determination is resurrected when Frank tries to take Jamie away from her by trying to take the silver ring. And now back at the manse, they're on to Whiskey. Frank had refused to leave her because she was pregnant. Quote, he said no one but a cad would dream of abandoning a pregnant woman with virtually no resources, unquote. And Claire acknowledges, quote, he was a very decent man, unquote. And there's the knowledge or suspicion that he couldn't have his own children, so staying with her enabled him to have a child. And since everything she said about Jamie was so unbelievable, the father of the baby was virtually unknown, and there wasn't anyone to say that the child wasn't his. But to provide for a break, he moved them all to Boston and accepted a post at Harvard, and it's where Brianna was born.
Now, that being said, they did not have DNA tests back then, but could you have imagined them trying to DNA, to try to match DNA with him? Or I'm just wondering what it would look like if they did like a DNA test, like an Ancestry.com DNA test on Brianna, like today. What that would look like. I mean, it'd be interesting.
It'd be interesting.
Because, I mean, but I know that when
we're all
mine,
a product of our past, so I don't think it would be that different. I think a DNA wouldn't be that surprising. It would just show she was Scottish or whatever. But a blood test or like antibody test, because part of your immune system is acquired and some of it is innate.
So nature, I'm not mistaken. Nature, even with that.
Well, not nurture. But I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's what you acquire. That's why kids are sick, right? The first like 2, 3, 5 mm-hmm. years of life.
Good Lord,
they're acquiring their immune system, or even 8 years of life. They're acquiring that part of their immune system. They're born with some of it. the antibodies from the mother. I guess it's from the mom. Maybe it's not from the dad. But it would be so interesting to see.
They get a lot of antibodies through the breastfeeding.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's the mom. I don't think dads do that much.
They don't breastfeed.
Cheryl M. writes, I loved how this chapter largely recounted the return of Claire to Frank, first in the hospital in Inverness when she had just returned from the Stones. It was nice to see where the show pulled inspiration for season two, episode one, Through a Glass Darkly. Now, some recall of bringing up Bree. Claire is exhausted from new motherhood and wakes to a crying Bree, whom we learn has turned over. Frank is in the bathroom and comes out to see what's going on. As Claire's pregnancy progressed, they both had been growing edgy. But when Frank first held Bree, he crumbled. Within a week, DG says he had been hers, body and soul. Now, this is a tableau of a content, normal family. Mom and dad and baby, dad holding baby, dad kissing baby's nose, dad laughing, or both parents laughing after the baby sneezes. This was the first time we learned that Claire had laughed in a year, and definitely the first time.
No, not the first time she'd laughed. It was the first time she'd laughed with Frank. Like, they hadn't laughed together. Okay, I didn't get that. What I took from that was that maybe singularly they had had laughing times. Like, she may have had points where she laughed with Bree by herself, but
I could definitely believe it. This was the first time they'd shared something.
Like, it was the first, like, kind of intimate moment they'd had together like that.
They have a moment, him there naked, her there with her wall down. The moment is broken by the smell of something burning. Frank gives her Bree and runs to the kitchen, dropping both towels he had on. So she sees his booty as he runs away. Connie S. writes, I hope this means we'll get another look at Tobias's rather nice derriere. Ellen G. writes, can't wait for more Tobias again. So people, I'm not the only Tobias fan. Frank is anti-teabag. He'll grab coffee on the way to uni, he says. Then he reminds Claire, oh, by the way, don't forget, we're having the dean and his wife to dinner tonight.
Do you know what teabagging is?
I did not say that. I said teabag.
I know, but if you said he's anti-teabag, I'm like dying over here. I laugh and you just moved past it.
Because I don't want to talk about that.
Oh my God.
It's not this kind of podcast.
I don't know anyone who's pro teabag.
A lot of Americans, I mean, like the bags.
I like forcing you into that conversation.
He reminds Claire that they're having dinner with the dean that night, Dean and his wife, and that she'll be bringing a gift for Bree. Claire feeds Bree in response to her rooting. She's hungry again. And Frank is observing this. Quote, Mrs. Hinchcliffe said that a baby shouldn't be fed every time it cries. It'll get spoiled if they aren't kept to a schedule. Claire retorts with, then she'll be spoiled, won't she?
Yeah. I don't know anyone who likes Miss Hinchcliffe.
I'm like, or Frank right now.
Haven't even... Yeah, you know...
Frank is just relaying information, but he does seem a little bit neener.
Well, it's not neener, but it's like, oh, well, she's clearly an expert on this subject, so...
Oh, yeah.
She said so, XYZ, so we should definitely do that. And I'd be like, piss off, dude.
Claire wasn't about to allow someone to tell her how to care for Bree. She, after all, had seen women of the 18th century practically connected to their children at the breast.
And she is technically an 18th century baby.
Oh, yeah. As he leaves, he asks if he should bring anything to save her going out, which I find that's very nice of him. Look, honey, should I bring you this? Should I bring you that? And she's like, no, I got it. I can totally handle it.
But can we talk about the idea of spoiling a child by feeding it when it's hungry?
Oh, I know.
How is that spoiling a child?
That's just silly.
Miss Hinchcliffe is stupid.
So she tells him, no, I'll manage. That's all fine. He was looking at Bree nursing. More pointedly, looking at her bosom, and she looked at him, and she saw because he's still standing there naked because he just came back from the kitchen, and she sees the beginning of his arousal, and she is affected by him. Quote, he didn't come into the kitchen again before leaving, so I had a chance to finish feeding Brianna, and bring my own feelings into some semblance of normality. Unquote. No, I'm not.
Normality or normalcy?
Sorry, normality.
Normality, okay.
Now I'm making up words. Her pregnancy, we learn, had been high risk, as it had been, ish, with Faith. There had been no question about sharing a bed, even if she'd wanted to, and she hadn't. Something had changed now. A connection had been made? Some wall burst through? They both sought solace in the presence of Brianna. Claire dealt with feelings by nestling and nursing her. Frank in cuddling and falling asleep with her. Remember in Outlander, sex was the way that they reached each other, Frank and Claire? It was now through Brie. Quote, the baby was our shared focus, a point through which we would at once reach each other and keep each other at arm's length, unquote. Connie S. writes, after Brianna's birth, they connected through the baby, whereas sex had once been their point of connection, the thing that sustained them through difficulties. Now, here's something that has... Okay, you ready?
I don't know.
Are you ready? Okay.
I don't know.
Listener, dear listener, get ready.
This better be good. With that kind of a lead-in.
I mean, this is like...
Did you find trees?
No more trees in this chapter. This is the root of all of everything that has been going on for like minimum 20 years. This huge controversy.
Oh.
Yeah, oh. Now here's something that a lot of controversy surrounding it. Many readers believe the following text is proof of Frank's infidelity. Quote, I knew Frank hadn't been celibate since my disappearance. In his late 40s, he was still lean and muscular, dark and sleek, a very handsome man. Women clustered about him at cocktail parties like bees around a honeypot, emitting small hums of sexual excitement, unquote. Now, we certainly see Claire's opinion. This is Claire's voice. But Diana assures us that it is just that, Claire's voice. This does not equate proof that Frank was unfaithful. Even the following, quote, there had been one girl with brown hair whom I had noticed particularly at the departmental party. She stood in the corner and stared at Frank mournfully over her drink. Later, she became tearfully and incoherently drunk and was escorted home by two female friends who took turns casting evil looks at Frank and at me, standing by his side, silently bulging in my flowered maternity dress. He'd been discreet, though. He was always home at night and took pains not to have lipstick on his collar, unquote. All of this is Claire's observation. Absolutely. She even admits there was no supposed proof, such as lipstick on his collar. Now, I admit, this is Ginger speaking, I automatically assumed since 1999, or in 1999, when I first read the book, that Frank had indeed been unfaithful. As a reader, I want to always believe and follow our heroine, and after all, she belongs with Jamie, and we know this, not with Frank. However, Diana has written many times that Frank was not unfaithful, or at least that there is no direct evidence. It's what we read into it. And we'll share her words in the bit she wrote called In Defense of Frank Randall, posted in 2005 on CompuServe and shared on another blog, which we'll post in the show notes.
The only thing that I will say, and the reason that that statement and that whole passage has people thinking that he is unfaithful, is because I can't think of another reason for a girl to show up at some sort of a faculty whatever and mournfully looking over whatever at him, and then having her friends escort her out after she's drunk and shooting daggers at them if they did nothing. So I'm not saying he physically acted on it, but there was something must have gone down between them for that whole interchange to have happened.
I didn't write the book.
I know you didn't. But having... It's almost like a deliberate... And I know it's just Claire's perception of the events that she's seen. But if that's not what we're supposed to think, then it's almost like deliberate subterfuge. Like misdirection. To make us believe that. And to help us not want her to stay with Frank.
Now, since we don't want to do an entire episode on this, should we maybe consider having this kind of a discussion related solely to this as like a, maybe, you know, not more than a half an hour, but maybe a Facebook live chat?
We could do that. I'm okay with that.
Now, what do you think, listeners? If you like this, let us know. And also, if you have any I think the Facebook Live is actually kind of one of a perfect, as long as we have give plenty of notice and, you know, put in the title like hashtag spoilers or something. A Facebook Live is a really nice way for us to be able to have a discussion or a chat-ish with people and they can interact. It's there if you want to go see it later on, but it's not something you and I have to produce. And then I have to go back and edit and all of that. And then we, you know, make it into an episode. Plus, we don't want one episode full of just spoilers. But I, in thinking about that, I'm like, you know, the Facebook Live kind of thing might be a great way for us to do quick and dirty little, you know, little things like this that we don't typically do. Because as long as we give plenty of warning and spoiler space, if you will, that's where we can kind of take some chats.
Well, and the beauty of Facebook Live is you get us completely unedited.
Oh my goodness. Apparently people like that. Oh my gosh. So if you have any ideas, first of all, if you like this, let us know. If you have any ideas for specific topics, like something as small, or even though this could go on for hours, that conversation could, it's gone on for 20 years. So we know it could go on for hours, but something that's a small enough tidbit like that, that we could focus on or chat about for, you know, 20, 30 minutes, give us some ideas. We're very happy to have you guys, you know, ask questions or provide stuff. That would be fun. Just email us or tweet us, whatever. Now, Claire's, this is a little bit facetious, but I mean, this is the truth. Claire's still hung up on Jamie. Of course, she wakes up in the night crying for him. Now, this day.
Hell, I wake up in the night crying for him.
Oh, Lord. This day that is described is truly the terrible, horrible, no good.
It's the Alexander and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day for sure.
Oh my goodness. Now, Bree has a diaper rash. She's pissy. Continually spits up. Claire has to keep changing her shirt. Claire's nursing bra is chafing her. Her nipples ached. The heater died. She has to wait for the repairman. And I love how she holds the receiver to Bree's crying face. So he like gets an earful.
It's effective.
Totally. The repairman's window is six. Window to come is 6 hours.
I mean, it's like Comcast right now.
They give you 6 hours?
Actually, they now have an app that will give you like so you can track your driver.
That's kind of
But
nice.
It used to be like
3 hours.
We'll be there between
hours.
12 and 4.
Yeah, but that's not six. Come
I know.
On.
But you know what? If PG&E, like the power's out, they're like, we'll get it back on later today.
Like in, or in two,
they
in
won't
the
even,
next day.
Yeah,
I know.
They won't even give you that much specifics.
Which is almost nicer.
To not give you specifics?
I don't know. Because if you can't promise, don't tell me.
Well, the thing is the problem with the heating situation is not only that they have a giant window, but she can't go anywhere.
Oh, yeah.
So she can't, she has to stay there because in the off chance
might be there.
That he shows
and you
up
know what?
And she's not there, he would, definitely
I promise
would.
You, he would show up. Yeah. He would show up. Yeah. But speaking of or thinking of a 6 hour window, oh my gosh, I am so happy with my upcoming 3 hour AT&T window. I'm like, got it. I'll be there. No problem. I mean, I was like, 3 hours? What? And then when I read, that was before I took notes for this chapter, and I thought, Ginger, be happy.
It could be six.
Be thankful.
It could be six.
Oh, it could be six in the middle of winter with no heat in, like, freezing.
With a crying baby.
Oh, Lord. Oh, my gosh. So she wouldn't be able to go to the market and get back in time because it's 11:30 right then. So she has some stuff delivered, and the house, oh, gosh, is reeking of ammonia. Neither of them are getting more than 10 minutes of sleep at a time. Finally, the heater guy comes. She finally gets dinner together and in the oven.
She no, but goes, he comes and he fixes it. He's like, eh, no promises. Meaning, I can't even guarantee the work I just
did. It's on right
did.
Now, but it may go off anytime. She goes to get herself and Bree changed. The kitchen is a mess. There was a pin in the new pink dress Frank had bought Bree to wear. And the poor baby was screaming in pain. And Claire had no idea what was going on. Now, and then of course she finds out, but now mom and baby are both crying. How awful was that? That just, when she's like, oh, and again, I was the first time this most recent read through or listen through, I listened to Davina first because I can listen to her on the drive. And then after that, I read to take notes. But Davina doing it was like, oh, just, it was heartbreaking just to hear her. As Claire, like, apologizing to this baby, you're like, this little creature that doesn't know this from that, and all they know is this caretaker, the one person they're most connected to, is causing them pain in some way, meant or not meant. And then the mom feels awful. I mean, I could not imagine. I could not imagine. Finally, they're changed. Frank comes home with a load of stuff for the evening, including wine. And what does he say? Christ, Claire, couldn't you fix yourself up a bit? I mean, it's not as though you have anything else to do at home all day. Couldn't you take a few minutes for unquote. And basically, bang goes the wine.
Dude, he's lucky. He's lucky he survived this whole encounter, because I promise you, if I'd had that day and somebody came home and tried to lay that on me, there would be dead people. I would be being arrested, and my child would be in protective custody with foster families, because that would have been it. Like, that would have been the cap to my day.
She takes off, and as she's leaving, she passes the evening's dinner guests. Lisa T. writes, "All I can say to Frank is be glad she didn't bash the Beaujolais on your headband."
Exactly.
Never go there with a new mom. Connie writes, "Dr. Spock," now Dr. Spock is mentioned in the chapter, "not to be confused with Mr. Spock, was the most influential authority on child rearing in the late 40s and for years after. Many parents regarded his book as gospel truth and followed his advice to the letter. Interestingly, he changed some of his own views on parenting over time," and you can read that in the Wikipedia article, which we'll link to, "yet babies still survived. Also keep in mind that this was the era of the baby boom, all those soldiers returning home and starting families. Millions and millions of babies were being born. The rural nuclear family was evolving into smaller family units in the suburbs, and many couples had no elders around to help with grandmotherly assistance. No wonder it was a big hit." Jean L. writes, "Claire's domestic life in Boston reminds me of her frustrating time in Paris when she had nothing better to do than have tea with her, quote, brainless ladies." Gabaldon paints a realistic picture of Claire, of caring for an infant, and the intensity of that messiness, and also shows us the pressures of a society, and Frank, who expect every woman and mother to be June Cleaver. Claire dumped courtly Versailles womanhood for a meaningful life at Hôpital des Anges. She is just as frustrated with the Leave It to Beaver lifestyle of the 1950s. We know where the story is going next.
I mean, it seems like that it's almost more constraining for her to be in the 1950s as it was to be in the 1740s.
France, yeah. Jessica L. writes, "I love the part where we get a flashback of Claire and Frank when Bree was a baby. It gives us an idea of what Frank and Claire's relationship was like once Bree was born to the time he died. Bree was their only connection to each other because Claire could never let go of Jamie, and Frank knew that. So I hope they keep this flashback in the show." I mean, there's going to be a hunka-hunka Bern and Tobias.
Let's
there has
be
to
honest.
Be.
They love Tobias. Oh, they're going to do what, if it's in the book and they don't even
I
have
think they're
to,
going to try and get Tobias in it. Well, hold on a second. Well, we can't.
There was no,
it.
You know what? There was,
I was
no
about
Tobias
to go through all
junk
books.
Season two. So it's time for it to come back.
Well, there was junk. It just wasn't on screen.
I mean, you mean them stabbing it? What junk?
Okay, there was even more junk. No.
The
child rapist.
Yeah, but he was not nude.
I didn't say that. I said there was junk involved. There was just non-screen.
Oh, no. I was purely speaking about him being naked on camera.
Okay. Then no.
And I'm saying they like Tobias. They write him in when they can. And
of course.
If he's already in the book, they're going to use him. And, you know, everyone needs a nice little...
Well, especially since there's no more BJR. You got to involve him somehow.
I mean, there will be. There'll be that scene in the beginning.
Where he's laying on him?
Yeah.
Can't say anymore because what you said last time was awful.
It was. But it's what went through my head because I'm awful.
Joe B. writes, "The role of mother suits Claire well, but brings her into conflict with Frank. This time of new parenthood is challenging enough without the grief and loss and adjustment both Claire and Frank are dealing with, although it seems that Frank is perhaps not grieving in quite the same way. So where does she end up? St. Finbar's Catholic Church. Perpetual adoration. Now, this harkens back to the Abbey in France after the escape from Wentworth. She doesn't go to Mass regularly here, but does apparently go to adoration. She knows exactly how to get in. She knows that, I don't know what time or what date she normally goes, but she has, at least for herself, she's there enough.
Oh, she knows the schedule. She's like, somebody new comes in every hour and, you know, new adoration people. And
She says she doesn't know why she does it. Quote, I can't really say. It's just something I need to do. It's peaceful there, unquote.
It's her version of meditation. Makes sense to me. She needs a place where she can go and clear her mind and not think about the stuff she has to think about outside of there.
She is able to find peace in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament. Quote, at last, as usually happened here. That's proof right there. Usually happened here, which means it's a frequent-ish thing. I ceased to think, whether it was the stoppage of time in the presence of eternity or only the overtaking of a bone-deep fatigue. I don't know, unquote. She prays, quote, O Lord, I commend to your mercy the soul of your servant James, unquote. And mine, she adds. So here she's praying for Jamie, even away from him. Connie S. lets us know that there is a Finbar, a Saint Finbar, but the only one she could find information on was the sixth, or the one from the 6th or 7th century, not the 12th century. And he was Irish.
Well, Diana told us that much, that yeah. He was Irish.
Now, this is something I learned from reading about religion and Catholicism specifically. According to tradition, God is outside, Catholic tradition, God is outside of time. I think most people would say that most religions believe that. God is outside of time and therefore not ruled by it. Whether or not Claire knew or thought about this specifically, she was practicing prayer for the dead, another tradition of Catholics. And the reason is because not only is God not ruled or limited by time and can thus apply the blessings or wishes of the supplicant to or on the person the supplicant is praying for, but also because only God knows the state of the soul at death. Even if Jamie were dead and in purgatory, another Catholic belief, purgatory that is, prayers for the souls in purgatory are also beneficial. So Jamie would either directly benefit being dead and then thus in purgatory, or some other way benefit. God could apply, or sorry, if he's dead and in purgatory, or some other way benefit. God could apply her prayers to him in Jamie's time while he still lived, before he died. This is actually central to Catholic teaching, if I'm not mistaken. The entire act of adoration means that you're in the presence of God, again, who was not bound by time, at the foot of the cross, at the resurrection, not a re-crucified Christ, but the one crucifixion at that time. That is also the belief of what Mass is. Gathering and remembering and participating in that moment outside of time. It's kind of hard to grasp your head around. It definitely was for me to kind of...
Write this?
No, not at all. No, to digest it. Now, if I misrepresented Catholic doctrine or tradition or practice in any way, please do let us know.
Let her know.
Let me know.
I'm good.
Summer's like, I'm good. Cheryl M. writes, I was pleased to see how Diana gave a very honest portrayal of how exhausting, draining, and sometimes frustrating it is to be a new mother caring for a young baby.
Yes, sometimes.
As Claire was going about her day trying to prepare for an important evening for Frank, there was obstacle upon obstacle getting in her way of completing all the needed tasks of the day. From Brianna's constant crying, from her diaper rash, to the heat going out and having to wait for the repairman. Despite her best efforts, she could not make the evening perfect in Frank's eyes as he comments on her disheveled look almost as soon as he walks in the door. Claire, strong woman that she is, did not accept Frank's out-of-line comment and walked out, leaving Brianna and Frank behind. She takes the space she needs to calm and center herself when she goes to St. Finbar's to participate in perpetual adoration. It is a call back to Outlander when she found peace in the chapel at the Abbey while Jamie recovered. Cheryl M. writes, I also found myself wondering how Claire adjusted to coming back to the 20th century after being gone for so long. It must have been strange to have things like running water and electricity again, or to have to be going to the market and prepare dinner for her husband. Claire is such a strong female character, and it is fun to see her in these time periods where men sort of dominate the world and to see her hold her own and do what she wants and thinks is right. I just love her. Joe B. writes, her adoration of the host is for her own sake, but it's also where she goes to vocalize in safety her grief for Jamie and everything he embodied. It is when Frank offers some awareness of her loss, he's dead then, that at this point he can offer Claire some compassion. He too knows what it's like to be separated from the one he loves. Frank came to the church, Well, this is more evidence that she came at least somewhat frequently. He knew this was a place to look for her at. She angrily asks him why he came after her. He expresses concern. Quote, I was worried about you. Unquote. Even the placement of their cars represents this protectiveness, kindness to Claire. Diana writes, his large Buick nestled protectively next to my small Ford. Unquote. Now, he says she's alone at night in a bad part of town, but still, Bree was left at home with a neighbor. At home, she feeds Bree, who only eats from one side. After she puts Bree down, Frank comes up behind her and asks, he's dead then? She responds, quote, I told you so. I told you so, I started to say. Then I stopped, closed my mouth, and only nodded, rocking slowly, staring at the dark crib and its tiny occupant. Now, that's Jamie, right? One sentence in the middle of this, like he's asking for assurance that no matter what she's feeling, he's not coming back. She reaches for the pump, but he takes it from her. He kneels and begins to suckle her to help relieve the pressure. Now, more religious imagery here, a Virgin Mary figure almost. Frank kneels at her feet and suckles. Diana describes how Frank's hands were gentle on her and they ended up on the floor of the nursery. So they go to town, right, Sam?
I think so.
Joe B. writes, again, through the mediation of baby Bree, that they have a physical reconnection, Frank suckling the hurting breast, emphasizing this so Claire, quote, lets the tide carry her away. It is a sign of understanding an acknowledgement of where they are now, neither expecting, and Claire certainly not wanting, a resumption of their previous relationship. I remember on their wedding night, Jamie tells Claire that he will honor Frank's spirit by serving his wife. And here, Frank does the same. Ellen G. writes, allusions of underwater, undulating fronds of Frank's hands, every action in slow motion, as if movement was through water. Wow, oh, wow, oh, wow. Was this a flashback that she tells Roger about, or was it all in her mind? I think this was another, hopefully, in her mind thing. Ellen P. makes a great point. When they finally make love, it is only because Frank finally understands that Jamie is dead and that he has been jealous of a ghost. Cheryl M. writes, he also takes a cue from their morning encounter in which he was naked and Claire had a brief lustful moment and helps her with milk, which quickly turns into their first intimate moment since her return through the stones. He does seem to want to try to get back to the intimacy they had at the beginning of their marriage. I can't wait to see how this relationship develops. Cheryl finishes. And Lisa T. writes, Frank has other ideas and kneels before her. They reconnect through her motherhood. Quote, is this how God felt? I wondered, seeing the adorers before him. Was he, too, filled with tenderness and pity? Frank's hands moved slowly, lifting me with the strength of a wave and laying me down on the shore of the nursery rug. I closed my eyes and let the tide carry me away. Unquote. Frank has finally helped Claire to shore, but she is still at the mercy of the tide, perilously anchored. I love that entire passage, so primitive and sensual, and a wee bit of foreshadowing. That, even though someone said underwater, I'm like, great, okay, I get it, that's very beautiful. Until I just read Lisa's comment about foreshadowing, again, because I had to copy and paste this. Until I just read it, I was like, wait a second, foreshadowing for a book of... Excuse me?
Am I going to use the F word?
No. Foreshadowing for a book like Voyager, like a ship? Like water? Is that what she means? Like, because maybe I'm making a wrong connection, but I just now thought about the ocean as in seagoing vessels. Wow. Okay then. Okay. Also, Lisa continues, it recalls the passage in Outlander when Jamie mentions that he feels like God himself when he is inside of her. Back at Inverness... Brianna arrives with the Mance. They have a discussion about butter and scones, and haggis, and Fiona calls her a Sassenach. Bree is delighted that she is one.
Everyone loves a nice nickname.
I thought you were going to say a knickknack. I'm like, yeah, that too. We're reminded just how tall Bree is. Almost a foot taller than Fiona. Quote, a medieval carving, strong boned and severe, with her long straight nose and the long hair glowing red gold, she might have walked out of an illuminated manuscript. vivid enough to endure 1,000 years unchanged.
Illuminated manuscript. That makes me think of the All Souls trilogy.
Mm. Roger realizes that this is what Jamie must have looked like. We also get some foreshadowing here. Who knows? But we are told that Bree has the same ability as Jamie to draw people to him. She was magnetic. When she laughs, her eyes, quote, slanted into blue triangles of amusement, unquote. Another reference to Jamie's slanted eyes. Bree was able to find a lot of stuff in the library. She brings up an old Highland legend, Leap of the Cask. It's a rock formation located some distance above a burn. I almost said above a bum. Above a burn. And is named after the story of a Jacobite laird and his servant. The man was known only as Dunbonnet. A young boy was bringing a cask of ale to his laird's cave and met some English dragoons. Keep this in mind. Young boy.
I do love the leaps they've made.
Huh? Oh, my goodness.
Like, I mean, granted, they are specifically looking for Jamie. So when you are looking to find history and things that include that person, you do tend to make certain leaps and jumps to try to make it fit. But that was a real big one, like, to make that kind of a jump to, like, I found a laird living in a cave who they don't talk about, and there's no specific qualities about him mentioned. However, he wore a brown hat, and I'm thinking, I'm going to make this work, because if he had red hair and everyone knows him as Red Jamie, he might wear a brown hat to cover his hair. So I thought that was, while an accurate jump they made, was a little bit of a stretch initially.
We don't know yet if it's an accurate jump.
I do.
We don't. I remember it was a young boy who had brought the cask of ale to a laird. The boy refused to answer any questions, and he was attacked by one of them, and he dropped the cask. Bree is concentrating on the Dunbonnet bit because with his red hair, it would make sense that Jamie may have worn a bonnet to cover it. And Bree even found Leap of the Cask on a map. It's near the village of Brochmorda, which is near Lallybroch. As they go in for dinner, Bree tells Roger, quote, what was it like for him, living in a cave for 7 years, and what happened to him then? Roger kissed her between the brows. I don't know, darling, but maybe we'll find out. Unquote.
And of course, now, Claire's all like, let's go get dinner.
Now, the reason I did that thing with the darling is because he had made some reference earlier to, she'd been called a Sassenach and a dog's body. And she said, if that's what you call people you like, what do you call people you don't like? And he said, darling, or don't like, I guess the opposite. So you have the kiss between the brows and him calling her darling. And looks like we're on our way. And so to be continued. Now, Joe B. writes, Bree is on the hunt. Having been raised by an historian, she knows how to follow and find a source. It is her determination that provides the next step forward. And the story of Dunbonnet, itself based on the story of a real James Fraser, a brown hat to cover red hair, location close to Lallybroch, they may have found their Jamie. It is here that Bree begins to find her father in history and imagines the life he had in a cave for 7 years. He's a real person, and her emotions are now more engaged in the search for her recognized father.
Yeah, this Bree's way more into the idea of it being a good thing or wanting to find out more, because at the last book, she's like, I don't care. I don't want to know anything about it.
She's throwing things through windows.
He's not my dad. You're not the boss of me. I mean, it was a petulant child thing, and now she's open to the idea more, I think.
Cheryl M. writes, I also have a little bit of love in my heart for Frank in this chapter. Despite having to deal with the events surrounding Claire's disappearance and return, he seems to be making an honest effort to heal their broken relationship and repair their marriage. And of course, he is an adoring father to Brianna. I think he realized almost immediately that his comment to Claire was wrong, and he wanted to apologize in his own way by going out to find her and bring her home.
But does anyone else have an issue with the fact that he left the 3-month-old baby sleeping in an apartment by itself and just told the neighbor, like, hey, just keep an ear out?
This was the 40s.
I guess. It was the 50s.
Sorry, the 50s. No.
It was 40.
It was only. She returned in 48.
So it had been 49?
About.
Okay. So it was almost the 50s. Yeah, no, I agree with you. But like this day and age, they would have been arrested for a child endangerment and neglect.
And Connie S. writes, my favorite phrase from this chapter, within a week, he had been hers, body and soul.
Please join us next week when we move on to part two entitled Lolly Rock. We'll be doing chapter four entitled The Dunbonnet.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, Audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/Outlander Pod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.